Do you believe, David, that we all have this ability? This could happen to all of us?
I think that's absolutely right. You know, we all have the same psychological mechanisms in our head. We're all scanning our environment rather, you know, subconsciously to try and find out what's good for me in the moment and what's good for me in the long term. And the mind is constantly trying to find that magic balance point. Sometimes it gets tripped up, but I definitely think we do. And as we'll talk more, you know, our experiments, I think, show that.
All right. And how about you, Carlo? When you were doing this research, come across any surprises?
A lot of surprises. I think Dave and I, whenever we conduct a study or whenever we think of a study, we always are of the mentality that it's just not going to work. But our participants continuously surprise us by proving to us that our manipulations, however subtle they are, actually cause them to change their moral behavior.
All right, let's talk about our choices here, our gut instincts. Should we try to reason carefully about moral choices? What do we do?
You know, that's a good question, and it's a debate that's been going on in psychology a lot the past 10 years. A lot of people, you know, half the people will say, well, you should go with your gut. Just trust your gut. Don't think about things. And the other half of the people will say, no. You have to really think and analyze stuff. And the problem is neither is right. I mean, if you think about it, right, we have this idea that our kind of intuitions are emotionally craven and all they want is stuff that's kind of, you know, vices and bad for us. And morality comes from self-control. But some of the most horrific things that have ever been done have come from just straight-up justification and moral rationalization. So what Carlo and I argue really is that, you know, we've lived on this planet for a lot longer, you know, humans and our ancestors, than we've had the cognitive architecture to engage in lots of really, you know, elaborate reasoning. And how did we survive as a social species? And so we argue this trade-off between long-term and short-term choices happens at both levels, at both our kind of gut level and both our intuitions. And what we try and tell people in the book is how and when to choose which one you should follow.
All right, let's talk about the hypocrites. Elliot Spitzer won. Here he was fighting his career in prostitution, only to get caught himself. Goes to CNN. I guess they've just canceled his show,
yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen there. I mean, what's wrong with this guy?
So I think that's a perfect example where our reasoning gets us into trouble. So what Dave and I found in a series of studies is that hypocrisy doesn't exist at the gut level. In fact, when we prevented our participants from thinking about their moral transgressions, they felt bad about them, and they judged their transgressions just as harshly as they would judge other people's transgressions. But if we gave them time to think about it, time to rationalize what they had done, then all of a sudden hypocrisy emerges. You start to justify your own bad behavior, but you don't take the time to do that for other people's bad behavior. So hypocrisy is a nice example of how your gut can drive you towards moral behavior, but your higher order reasoning can drive you towards bad behavior.
Okay, let's talk about some different things and go through some of the methods that you used and the kind of people. David, any particular kinds of characters? When you talk about liar, cheat, sinner, saint, let's go through all of them and categorize what they do and how they do it. Let's start with the liar. What does he do?
Well, you know, I think most of us, when we've all confronted situations in our lives where if we told a lie, it would actually be expedient in the short run. That is, it could actually kind of prevent us from being caught at doing something, save somebody else's feelings, et cetera. And so, you know, in that moment when we have the opportunity to tell a lie, you know, our short-term impulses are saying, go ahead, tell the lie, and if you can get away with it, that's a good thing. The problem is, right, as you said at the start, we can build up a reputation. And so if we continue to lie and we're caught, then sooner or later people are going to assume, I think incorrectly, but they will assume, that we're always going to lie, and then nobody's going to want to interact with us. And the one thing we know from psychological research is that humans, both physically and mentally, do the best when they are involved in really strong relationships with other people. And if you're labeled a liar, that's not good. And so in that instance, when you're going to tell a lie, we have this impulse to say, yes, I should lie, but part of our gut is going to feel badly about that. And if we take the moment to think about that, it can help us prevent engaging in rationalization to say, well, it was okay to lie to this person this time because it saved their feelings, or because it allowed me to get away with something.
All right, you agree with that, Carlo?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, this is the liar is the perfect example where you see the benefits of long-term interests relative to the cost of the short-term. The lie can get you in trouble when you develop this reputation and it, when it begins to threaten the social relationships that we depend so much on to thrive.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about someone like Tiger Woods. You know, I don't want to look at names. I don't want to point fingers. We don't want to implicate people, but it is what it is. He was a guy who was very successful, made zillions of dollars, played around, but he was married. He could have done all this being single. Nobody would have cared. But the fact that he got married, it all caved down on him. Why would he get married in the first place, David?
Well, you know, I think all of us, well, most of us, I think, value long-term stability, right, at some level. And I think for Tiger, that was probably part of the case. You know, biologically, there is this impulse to be promiscuous at times. In fact, you know, Carla and I always talk about research that shows how people can cheat on their spouses even though they don't intend to. So, for example, people who chart female hormonal cycles, what you'll see is when women are the most fertile, they will tend to show more skin. Now, they're not consciously doing this, but it's kind of a non-conscious mechanism to increase the odds that there's going to be some mating going on. And so it's a way that the subconscious mind puts you in a situation that increases the likelihood that these things are going to happen. And with men, in the case of Tiger Woods, certain ratios, hip-to-waist ratios, are very attractive to men. And if you look at the women he was involved with, they tend to have these, whether surgery or not, accentuated ratios, which makes them harder to resist. And so I think Tiger's problem was a combination of putting himself in a situation where he was exposed to these temptations, but also the increased power makes one feel that it's okay. And in fact, there's research showing that the more power you have, the more you feel the regular rules don't apply to you.
Any surprises for both of you while you were writing the book and doing the studies?
So as I said, you know, Dave and I go into these studies. I mean, I think literally before every study that we conducted together, we'd turn to each other and say, this just isn't going to work, but what the heck, let's try it anyways. And that it ends up working. And the reason that it's so surprising is because the experimental manipulations that we use are so subtle and so outside of the awareness of our participants, yet they have very significant influences on their behavior. So anytime that happens, that's a pleasant surprise for me.